What's up, everybody? Movie retrospective time. Doing an old black and white classic.
Yeah, but it was color.
Well, no, it's not really, but... Well, here's the situation with this. Okay, so this is Carnival of Souls from 1962. And obviously this movie was shot in black and white, and that's how I've seen it, like, most times. Like, I've seen this movie probably, like, 20 times. And the black and white cinematography is quite beautiful, you know, especially considering how inexpensive this movie was to make. However, I thought Tom had already seen it, and I was like, well, I've seen it a bunch of times, so let's watch one of the Riff Trax versions, because they actually did a regular version, they did a live version, and I also have a version on DVD that's just Mike from, you know, from MST/Riff Trax doing a commentary on it, and that's also the colorized version. I don't love the colorized version. They did a good job colorizing it, but... honestly, if you're gonna watch this and you're not gonna, like, you know, have fun with it like Riff Trax did, which is kind of what I was in the mood for, I would definitely recommend just watching the regular black and white version, because I think that when they colorize it, I think it loses a lot of the atmosphere that it has, but, or, you know, that it originally had. But I saw that very recently they had just released a Criterion Collection one that's all been remastered and it's 4K and everything, and that's supposed to look like, you know, dynamite. So I haven't seen that version. This movie is another one where, like Night of the Living Dead, it sort of accidentally got into the public domain because of, like, some paperwork errors or some shit like that. So at least in the United States, it's public domain. Like, not in other countries. I think they sorted it out.
Which means everything's a bootleg.
Yeah, so yeah. So that's why you kind of see this movie everywhere. Like, you can watch it for free on Tubi. You can watch it's on Shudder. It's on, you know, it's everywhere. And that's why, because it's, like, really cheap. And that's why probably Riff Trax have done it, like, 3 or 4 times at this point, just because it's, like, you don't have to pay anybody. So, as I said, this came out in 1962. Now, this was made by a dude named Herc Harvey, who also plays the main ghoul in this, like the guy that's pursuing the main character. He actually worked for Centron, and if any of you guys, and I know, because I know some of you guys are like Mystery Science Theater fans, Centron was probably one of the largest producers of those kind of like short films, like educational films, industrial, you know, why study industrial arts and all that kind of stuff. So they did all of those, and that's what Herc Harvey was mainly doing. He was shooting those. He also taught filmmaking and things like that as well. So he was just like shooting, you know, short educational films. And I guess the impetus for him making a feature film was actually the site, you know, the abandoned carnival, which I think is actually, that's in Utah, where, and they say that in the movie, that that's where it is. And it's on the Great Salt Lake, like it's a place called Saltaire or something. And so he liked the look of that so much that he basically approached a dude, like a screenwriting dude he knew. And he said, okay, well, like one of the last scenes has to be like a bunch of ghouls like dancing around in this abandoned, you know, carnival. But up to that, like just figure something out. Like just so this was kind of one of those cases, and I kind of say this, if you don't have a lot of money to make a movie, like find a really good setting and like write a movie around that. And that's essentially what this dude did.
Yeah, it's been said over and over again to do that. Escape from New York was that.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I mean. And the thing about it, so the guy, this movie, back in the day, I think it cost $33,000 to make, which even back then was... amazingly cheap. I think that's kind of like 200 grand, 250 grand in today's money, which again, even today, that's very, very cheap.
Yeah, if you have to pay people.
Yeah, and that, well, that's the thing. And the crew, I believe the crew was only 5 people. And like I said, the director also starred in the movie, like as the ghoul. And Candace Hillegoss, who was the main character, she had been a theater actress. And I think she was only in maybe 2 other movies subsequently, because like I said, these were mostly like theater people.
Yeah. You know. She's the main attraction to this movie.
Yeah.
She kind of looks like that woman from Species. She's pretty good looking.
She is. Oh. She was only 20 when she made this.
Other than that, I think that, you know, go ahead. Other than that, this movie, I think it's unwatchable.
You think?
Yeah, it's unwatchable.
Well, like I said, it's kind
of
hard.
You're going to want to see a rich Riff Trax. Riff Trax made it fucking very bearable. It was funny.
The thing about this movie is that... You have to kind of be in the right mood to watch it, because a lot of it is, it's all kind of atmosphere. But the thing about this movie that why people bring it up, why it's such a classic, why Criterion wanted to do a, you know, a restore on it, is that it was really, really influential. And I'm not really sure, I mean, I don't think he was setting out to make, like, an influential movie. I think it was, like, a combination of this kind of surreal type of story that he did, which was a little bit ahead of its time, and the fact that the budget was so low, and that some of the things in it, like the acting is very strange, and like kind of like some of the people weren't actors, and some of the editing was kind of strange. So I think that the juxtaposition of those two things kind of hit this sort of weird sweet spot where, because I think even like filmmakers like, you know, George Romero,
Cronenberg,
David Lynch, you know, maybe Roman Polanski, because this has a little bit of a Repulsion vibe to it too. You know what I mean? Which, you know, like I said, came out after this. So I feel like this inspired, even though it's not, I don't know if you'd call it like an objectively good movie, but there's something about it. And honestly, I've watched like a shit ton of reviews of this, and some of the like, you know, horror channels and stuff. And some of the guys are like young, like in their 20s or whatever. And there's like, there's just something about this one that just kind of like, there's just like an atmosphere about this one that's like really, really creepy and like unsettling. You know what I mean?
As I was watching it, it reminded me of a very early Cronenberg.
That's yeah, kind
of. Like, you know, before Cronenberg really had any money, it reminded me of something like that. Although Cronenberg was taking it to another level.
Well, yeah.
But it wouldn't surprise me if Cronenberg had seen this movie.
I think a lot of people saw this movie because I feel like when it came out in 1962, as I said, they've kind of fucked up the copyright, and so they didn't really get, you know, so it went into the public domain really quickly. I think it was released like just as, you know, the as a part of a double bill, which is something they did a lot back then, like for drive-in theaters and shit. The other movie that was released alongside was The Devil's Messenger. So people like went to see it, but no one was really talking about it. It didn't really make any big splash. It seemed like later on, you know, I guess through it getting shown on TV because it was free to show and things like that, that it started getting like more of a cult following. And so I think that a lot of people that were into filmmaking just through word of mouth ended up seeing this movie and finding something in it that was like inspirational to them. You know what I'm saying?
I think the inspiration was is that they saw that thing and they said, boy, for short money, you can make a movie. And it wasn't that bad. You know what I mean? It's probably all
it was. That's kind of like the same, like I said, it's kind of the same spirit that's, you know, spurred the whole punk movement and everything like that. It's like, you know, if they can do it, I can do it too.
Right.
I definitely think George Romero was influenced by this movie big time.
I gotta say, Night of the Living Dead is fucking just light years ahead of this.
It is, but like I said, you can see where this comes from.
Yeah, I can. Yeah.
And I mean, the thing about Night of the Living Dead is that, one, he had like a larger crew. He didn't have, honestly didn't cost that much. I think it maybe cost twice as much to make as this, if I'm remembering correctly.
But you know what? You could almost kind of say things for Manos. Manos was kind of like that too. That dude had nothing. He was working with nothing. And he made a kind of a watchable, entertaining flick.
Well, I kind of think this movie is not nearly as bad as Manos.
Oh, man.
But
for some reason, that Manos worked.
But I think that that's kind of what filmmakers like George Romero and people like that were responding to.
I think they saw that and go, oh, I can do that. I can do better.
That too. But it's also kind of like I said, it's this weird mix of kind of like an inspired idea and then sort of like these budgetary limitations and like just the way it's shot, like almost kind of makes the juxtaposition almost makes it like more surreal. You know what I'm saying?
Although in the case of Manos, it was by accident.
Yeah.
But I
think it was kind of by accident in this one, too.
Yeah.
I don't think that he set out, because like I said, the guy, he was a competent filmmaker. He made, you know, short films, so he knew how to edit, he knew how to do all that kind of stuff. But, and like I said, he taught filmmaking as well. But I don't know if he taught it before or if he taught it later, but he worked for Centron for a really long time. And actually, he took a 3-week vacation from his job at Centron to make this movie. So they made it in 3 weeks. They made it in, I think the first part, you know, before she leaves for Utah, they made it in Kansas, Lawrenceville. I think it was Lawrenceville, Kansas. And then they shot the rest of it in Utah because, like I said, he found that carnival, like that abandoned carnival, and he just thought it looked so great, and so they should put it into a movie. So the story of this, if you don't know, and like I said, we're going to spoil it, so it's 1962. Come on, get with the program. And like I said, it's fucking free. So
yeah, and I'm just going to go ahead and say, if you're going to watch this, watch the Riff Trax colorized version.
Although, like I said, if you're seeing it, well, I just wanted to watch the Riff Trax version because I've seen the original so many times, and I was just kind of like, oh, well, I'll watch. But I wouldn't recommend, if you're not going to watch the Riff Trax, I wouldn't recommend watching the colorized version because it doesn't look that good. I think the black and white cinematography is much nicer, and I think that it adds a lot more to that, like the atmosphere of it. To me, it's like way creepier in black and white. Like when you colorize stuff, it never looks quite right to me.
That's Jenny's advice. Me, without that commentary, I don't think I'd have been able to get through this. I think I'd have fallen asleep. It just, I didn't like it that much. Although I liked the Riff Trax version of it. I was laughing.
The Riff Trax version of it are really funny. There's, like I said, there's more than one.
Yeah. So I don't know. It just depends on your movie tastes. It was nowhere near as good as The Night of the Living Dead. You know what I mean?
Well, no. Well, like I said, this one, it's almost kind of like. And honestly, not even kind of like, it's supposed to be dreamlike because essentially that's kind of what it is. I mean, it's kind of left ambiguous, but so like I said, we're going to spoil it because I feel like everybody has seen this or at least, you know, is familiar with the story.
The artistic elements to the tone of this movie, like she's talking about, I'm going to say it's kind of like Manos, Hands of Fate.
It does have that vibe to it. I don't think he did it on purpose.
It was not some kind of an artistic statement. It was they were working within the limitations of what they had.
Yeah.
And it is kind of creepy, but it depends. It's your mileage may vary. Depends on what you're into. I mean, if you're, I don't know, you said some young guys watched it and liked it. Maybe it's because it's just so alien to them, you know.
It's one of the, just the whole tone of it is just very, very strange.
Yeah.
And like I said, I don't think that that was intentional.
No.
I think that that was just kind of like a happy meeting of like this sort of weird, surreal type of story.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it is kind of like a surreal story. And the limitations of their budget and like, what they were working within.
When I was watching it, I wasn't really expecting anything. It was kind of plodding and going a little bit slow for me. The things that did happen, I kind of saw them coming. It's like I said, your mileage may vary. It wasn't really for me. Now with the Riff Trax version, I can recommend that. I was appreciating. You get to see the movie, and then you get to see somebody riffing on the movie, and I just thought that was a good experience.
And actually, I will say, if you want to watch if you've seen the original so many times like I have, The Riff Trax versions, there's a regular Riff Trax version and a live Riff Trax version, and they are both on Tubi for free. I'm not sure if I think the one with just Mike, the commentary with just Mike Nelson, I think that's on there for free too. I have it on DVD, but I'm pretty sure you can watch all three of those versions as well as the original version. All of those you can watch on Tubi, so you can have an all-day fucking marathon if you want to.
Yeah, so I guess what Jenny and I are trying to say is that if you're like a serious student of film or a connoisseur, you'd see the original. But I think if you're just a regular pedestrian person, I'd probably just go for the Riff Trax one.
Yeah. I mean, well, like I said, it depends on how into film you are, how into, you know, how patient you are with like 60s movies.
Yeah.
How much are you into like surrealism? How much are you into movies that are almost all atmosphere, because that's what this is.
Yeah.
Like I said, I can, more than anything, I kind of feel, and this may be a weird thing to say, but I can really, really see like David Lynch was really kind of inspired by this movie because a lot of his shit has the same kind of like
weird blocky kind of chunky,
just weird kind of dialogue. Yeah. Now he does it on purpose.
Yeah.
This one I don't think it was necessarily done on purpose. I just think some of the, I mean, like I said, Candace Hillegoss, she was only 20 at the time that she was in this, but she had been like a stage actress. So some of these people were actresses, but a lot of them were not. And that's pretty apparent, like, if you watch the movie. But in a way, that kind of, like, lends to this really weird, just, like, unmoored from reality kind of vibe.
Yeah, everybody feels and seems very uncomfortable, including you, as watching it. It's very chunky, unrealistic, blocky dialogue. The delivery is kind of deadpan or just weird, altered because of bad acting. But it looks like it's done on purpose. It isn't, though. It's done by accident.
Well, like I said, David Lynch does this shit, but he does it on purpose.
Right. It does kind of take, kind of puts you into a weird kind of...
Yeah, you're like,
what?
Like, it's unsettling.
Yeah.
And I think that's what a lot of people are responding
that's
to,
what
like
they're talking
I said.
About, yeah.
So yeah.
Manos did that same kind of thing, but different reason.
Not on purpose.
Not on purpose. Yeah, the thing with Manos is that they couldn't ever film anybody talking.
Yeah.
Because everything was dubbed.
They didn't have sync sound. They didn't have sync
all the sound was added. Now, some of the sound is added in this later. You can tell a lot of it's overdubbed. And that was weird, too. Like out on the bridge.
Interestingly, it's weird because like it seems like at the beginning of this movie, there was a lot of like overdubbing.
Yeah.
But then later, they had sync sound and it was fine. And he knew how to do that.
Right.
So I feel like maybe what happened is when he was shooting the original scenes, maybe something fucked up that maybe they didn't get the audio and they had to go back and redo it.
I think wind was getting them outside.
Maybe that's
wind
what it was.
Blowing on the
because
microphone.
Later on, it was perfectly fine.
Yeah.
Like they did everything just fine. But so the story of this, Candace Hillegass, she plays this woman named Mary Henry. Now, you don't know anything about her life prior to any of this, really. She doesn't go much into it. The movie starts very abruptly. It's basically just kind of her and two other girls.
Yeah, when it started, I went,
in
did
a car.
It start?
And yeah.
Like, yeah.
That's so, how it starts.
This is how it starts. Because,
yeah, that's how it starts.
Yeah, it's weird.
So it's two of her girlfriends in a car. And then there's another car with a couple of douchey dudes in there, and they're just like, hey, challenging them to a drag race.
Yeah.
And the girl that's driving, who is never named or anything, and they're just like, okay, that sounds like a good idea. So they go on, like, the world's slowest drag race. And then, so they're on this bridge, which is in Kansas, and, essentially the dudes, it kind of looks like the boys' car is supposed to have, like, run them off the bridge. They actually did, fun fact, they did actually wreck that bridge. Because the townspeople, they were like, hey, can we drive a car off the bridge? And the town, you know, whoever, mayor or whatever, he was like, yeah, as long as you pay to fix it. You know how much it costs to fix it? $12. So they drove a fucking car off the bridge. So the girl's car goes off the bridge.
Yeah, it was real, too.
They don't have special effects. Yeah. So they're just like, well, we've got to
there
drive.
Goes the car.
There goes the car. Well, they'd had to film that last.
Cars weren't worth much money back then anyway.
That's true.
Yeah.
So the car goes into the water. And then, you know, all the cops come, obviously. And they're, like, dragging the lake or river or whatever it is in, you know, the most inefficient way possible. And basically, they're like, oh, the current's too strong. We're never going to find that car. Now, I didn't catch this, but I guess somebody says that it's like 3 hours later and they still haven't found the car. And then all of a sudden, Mary, played by Candace Hillegass, comes climbing out of the river. And, you know, and she seems fine, but she doesn't really remember, like, what happened. So they're just kind of like, how the fuck, you know, no one says this, but you're like, how the fuck did she stay under there like all that time and still be alive? So they put a blanket around her and they're like, holy crap, whatever. And so then they cut to the next scene.
Yeah.
And she's playing this enormous pipe organ.
Yeah. Now, Jenny forgot to mention a few things.
What did I forget to mention?
The dudes driving the car were fucking hilarious looking. The one dude had a hat that was fucking bizarre.
Yeah, and on Riff Tracks, they had a great time. They had a great time making fun of
that. Yeah, and he kind of looks... and it's hard to tell how old they are. I think they were in their 20s.
But everybody looked old.
But they all looked kind of old the way they dressed.
Even 20-year-olds look like 45-year-olds.
He looked like fucking, what's his name, Abbott from Abbott and Costello.
He did a bit, yeah.
Like, no. He looked like Costello, a little short, fat guy. Wasn't he the... Which is,
oh, yeah. Costello's the fat one.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, Costello looked like the fat one. But he wasn't fat. He just looked like that. And
he was husky.
Yeah. It was funny. The girls were cute in the car.
Mm-hmm.
Probably late teens, early 20s. But there's something about that hair that made them look like old ladies, even when they were young. It's funny. I guess because we associate that with old lady hair.
I think that's probably what
it
is. Because I was actually surprised to find out that that the actress that played Mary was only 20.
Yeah, and she looked like the oldest one out of
this.
Out of the
and she
bunch.
Did. She looked like, she didn't look like an old woman, but she looked like...
She looked like she's about 30.
She looked like she was in her 30s.
Yeah,
that's what I thought.
It's that hair, though.
I think that's definitely what it is.
Now, she is cute. She looks just... Reminded me of that woman who played the chick out of fucking...
Natasha Henstridge.
Yeah, Species. She looks like that.
Her face does look a bit like... She's got great bone structure.
Yeah, real thin and... So she, you know, and the other ones were cute too. That they went off into the drink and died in
pretty
the movie. You don't see them anymore.
Yeah,
but just kind of funny to see it. And they had it all colorized, the colorized version. I thought the color was convincing. It looked like it was shot in color. I think they did a pretty good job. Jenny didn't like it, but
well, I don't like it because the black and white cinematography was so pretty was like yeah. You know, I thought the black and white cinematography looks much nicer.
I didn't have any kind of preconceived notion about it. To me, the color, because I'd never seen it. To me, the color looked good, and it did.
Well, I'm saying they did do a good job on the colorization. It does look real,
I thought it was interesting to see all that 50s and 60s stuff in color. And one of the things I noticed is like how bad the paint jobs were on cars back then. I remembered those cars were jalopies when I was a little kid, but I remembered them. Man, the paint was shitty. Really shitty.
Well, yeah, everything was kind of shitty.
Everything was kind of
crappy.
Nobody
knew any better.
They didn't have good quality stuff. The technology wasn't there yet.
Yeah.
And the interiors and everything. So if you were around California or in the South in the 70s, a lot of this stuff, you know, you hadn't seen it in a long time. You're like, oh, I remember fucking wallpaper that looked like that. I'm glad that's gone. That kind of shit, you know? The porcelain bathrooms and shit.
Yeah.
With all the tiles and everything. I'm glad all that shit's gone.
Yeah, like I said, everything's kind of crappy.
It looked all crappy, yeah.
So she supposedly recovers from this accident. Doesn't seem all that put out about it. And by the way, her two friends are dead. You know, we're presuming because they never did find the car. So she immediately is like, she's playing this big pipe organ. Like I said, this is not the movie to watch if you don't like pipe organ music. Because, man, there is a lot of... But like I said, it goes in with the whole carnival theme. The dude that did all the score is named Gene Moore, by the way. And I think they actually released this whole album of this. Because the music is actually kind of creepy. But so she's playing that. And it turns out that that's her job. She's like, she's an organist. And, you know, she went to college for it and everything. I don't know if she really knew how to play the organ or if they were just pretending. I don't know. But, so she basically says to the guy that she's working for, yeah, I got a job as a church organist out in Utah, so I'm going to leave right away. And then they're building up stuff like, they keep asking her questions like, well, are you going to stop and see your family? And she's like, no, I don't have time to do that, whatever. And she's, and then, like, the guys are talking about it, like, wow, she seemed to, like, get over her being, like, fucking pulled out of the fucking river after 3 hours underwater. Like, she seems to be recovering from that pretty well, but they think it's, like, kind of weird.
Yeah.
So, what?
Now, here's another thing Jenny's not mentioning. And this is the phase of the movie where you're getting to see all the old white guys that run the show in this fucking movie. These dudes, man, looking at them and just the way they are, kind of fucking reminds me of fucking meeting your grandparents when they were a little bit young. These are the people that your grandparents looked up to. They were just like they were from another fucking universe.
Dumpy weirdos.
What's that?
Dumpy weirdos.
Yeah, dumpy. Kind of weird and
super straight laced.
Real straight laced and real early 60s tie wearing motherfuckers with their hair greased back and slicked back and gray and a little bit dumpy and overweight and kind of moral authority type guys. I think that'd be a good way. Everything is some kind of a moral authoritative lesson. You know what I mean? They're helping, guiding you through reality. You know what I mean? They're trying to explain to you. They're mansplaining. Oh, they're fucking mansplaining. Mansplaining to the... And it's just like you'll get two of them on screen and they will mansplain to each other so you can overhear it in a movie so you can understand an entire concept that they're trying to teach you. It's a trip movie if you look at it that way you're talking about. It is weird.
Well, yeah.
It is weird.
Yeah.
It's a lesson teaching motherfucker. It's trying it, but I'm not sure what the lesson was.
Well, I don't even know if that was intended so much.
It's just the way they delivered dialogue.
Yeah. Well, it's exposition. That's
yeah,
what they
exposition,
were doing.
Yeah.
It's just like an exposition where, you know, we're being led to think that, you know, you would think that she would be acting differently because of, like, a traumatic... I mean, if you went off a fucking bridge into a car, and even if you lived, but your two best friends, presumably, were in the car and they died, and it was only, like, a few days ago, you'd think you'd be more like... But she's just kind of like, whatevs.
Yeah, but in a modern movie, they never would have mentioned that. They just would have kept on going. It'd be on you as the viewer.
Well, yeah, but I kind of...
what the hell.
Yeah, in the 50s, they didn't really trust people to figure shit out on their own.
They had to tell you how to feel.
So everything had to be kind of explained.
Explain to you how you should be feeling about this. Explain to you how you... Because they're trying to tell you what is normal.
Yeah.
And it's not normal, so therefore you should feel like that. So that was just kind of a weird 50s and
whereas 60s, like you said, if they made it nowadays, they wouldn't have that conversation. They wouldn't, because, you know, and movies nowadays do have exposition sometimes, but if you have exposition in a movie nowadays, everyone's going to jump on your shit about it, because you don't really need that.
Yeah.
Like, people are sophisticated enough to be like, okay, I got it. Like, right. You don't have to tell me, you don't explain like your plot to me. You know what I mean. But back then, I guess they felt like they had to.
I think it was two things. One, it was written for the lowest common denominator. Two, they were trying to fill the movie out.
Well, yeah, because, and this movie is like pretty short, too. It's only like 84 minutes, I want to say. There's some cuts that are shorter, like that are 79 minutes. I think it's about 84 minutes is like the director's cut, like the way it was supposed to be seen. So she ends up driving to Utah. And on the way to Utah, she starts seeing, you know, what will become kind of familiar later on, like, throughout the movie, is that she starts seeing this dude, like, a ghoul-looking dude, like, visions of him. She sees him, like, in the car window, and she sees him, and then, like I said, that's the director, Herc Harvey, playing that part, you know, just wearing two hats, so it's, like, saving some money, you know, like you do. And so she gets to Utah, she gets a job as a church organist, and it seems very, upsetting to people that she's really kind of, I mean, nowadays it wouldn't be that big a deal, but it's like she seems almost like she didn't say she's an atheist, but she's just kind of like, oh, I just work at a church and play the organ, you know, I play an organ for money. And it's like, so a church is just like any other job, it's just like any other business, which, like I said, is not controversial to say nowadays, but in 1962 everyone was like flipping the fuck out about it, and all this other kind of shit. So you're being, as I said, you're being led to believe that there's something the matter with her, like fundamentally the matter with her, since the accident, right? So as it goes on, she starts having not only seeing, because she gets like a room in a boarding house with like the weirdest landlady ever.
Yeah.
I love her character though. I love that landlady. She's like so fucking funny. I love that she's so obsessed with telling the girl, you can take all the baths you want. Like, I'm not one to get upset about. She says, like two or three times. And it's just, like, so, so funny that that's, like, the thing that she's, like, latching onto. And I'm like, is this woman a pervert or what? And speaking of perverts, there is another boarder in the house. Like, this dude, I think his name is John. Yeah. And he lives across the hall from her. And this dude is, like, a total fucking skeeze.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, it has to be seen to be believed.
Yeah.
Like, what a skeeze this dude is.
Yeah. And I'm not sure if he was supposed to be that skeezy in the 60s. He might have been kind of normal for the 60s. It's hard to say.
Was supposed to be a skeeze, though.
Was he? Okay. He was supposed to be kind of like a futuristic kind of a guy who was cool with shit. It's hard to say, because
I'm pretty sure he was supposed to be a skeeze.
The people who wrote this kind of stuff, what they thought was normal and what they thought was cool was a lot different.
And I'm pretty sure back then he was supposed to be a skeeze, just because the way she was reacting to him and stuff. But I think, like, from today's standards, I think you'd be like, you'd restraining order. That'd be like Mr. Restraining Order right there. It's like, please get the fuck, because he won't.
Yeah, but they did a lot of stuff back then.
The thing about it though is like, he'll come to the door, like he just comes in, like he's not invited in or nothing. Yeah. It's like he won't leave. And it's just like, he's just constantly hovering over and he's like way too close and shit like that. And he's like following her and shit. It's like, it's creepy as hell. And he's just like a total, he brings like shit over to her house, like uninvited. It's like he's coming over.
Yeah, well, today that'd be totally unacceptable. That'd be like set on 10. But back in the 60s, that may have not been like on a 10 setting.
I kind of feel like maybe back then it was a 6 or so.
More like a 6, right, yeah.
Like, because I think he was supposed to be a creep. But
it comes off even worse now.
But now it comes off even worse than it would have back then. Although even back then, I'm pretty sure that he was supposed to come across as
a... But I think back then he was like maybe half as bad as you would see it now.
Yeah, nowadays, like I said, you'd be like spraying with mace.
Because some of their value system was real different.
Yeah, totally creepy.
Yeah.
I mean, and in some ways, like I said, because I think one of the things, her interactions with him, I think are supposed to show... Again, yes, he's supposed to be a creep, but also they're trying to highlight her being abnormal because she doesn't want a relationship.
Yeah.
Which is weird, because you'd think, to make that more clear, I think they should have made the dude like a normal, nice dude. Yeah. By making him like this creepy skeeze, it almost kind of seems like, oh, well, she doesn't want a relationship with this guy. What the fuck is the matter with her? I'm like, maybe she just doesn't like that dude.
Yeah, well, I think...
because he's like a fucking sleazebag.
I was watching that too, but I think we were supposed to be seeing it from the viewpoint of a young person in the 60s. And that was the very beginning of kind of like the sexual revolution was just starting, you know? And they had, what do you call them guys? Guys that listened to all the jazz, the beatniks and shit. Those guys had been around for a long time. I think what we were supposed to see is kind of like the equivalent of a punk rock dude who just met some goth chick. They were fucking bored, you know what I mean? Boarding in this house. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that you're like a normie in the movie theater watching a punk rock guy and a fucking goth girl. That's what I think it was supposed to be. But it didn't translate to modern culture. That's what I think it was.
I mean, she straight up says later on to a doctor that she just kind of stumbles across, which I'll get to in a minute, that she is... doesn't have any interest at all in relationships, not romantic relationships or friendships or anything. Yeah, she basically just wants to be alone. But like I said, they're trying to highlight her...
Being weird.
Or being like... her whole thing, she even says later on in the movie, she even says, I don't belong in this world. Yeah. Which, like I said, it turns out to be very literal.
Yeah. Well, now that fits in right in from with the 60s and the late 50s kind of thinking. A woman's job back then was to be in a relationship. That was her job.
And if you didn't want one,
then there was something wrong with you, yeah. But I think they're just kind of showing it. I think there was a lot of people that felt that way. You know what I mean? So they were trying, like I said, you're supposed to be a young person in a theater, I think, seeing kind of like the version of a goth girl and a punk rock dude hooking up in a boarding room. But it doesn't come across that way to us because it's just the styles. They're so kind of old people and fuddy-duddy from our point of view.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's not translating. The cultural equivalence is hard for us to see. I think that's what it was, though. They were supposed to be cool kids.
Yeah.
I think.
Although, like I said, she comes across as much older than a 20-year-old. She comes across much older than he does, even though they're probably the same age. Or actually, he might be a little bit older, but he comes across... I mean, he is supposed to be, like I said, kind of a creep because he's clearly an alcoholic. They're not trying to, like, sugarcoat that at all.
Well, it's like a punk rocker, though.
Yeah, he's, like, drinking in the morning and shit like that. So, like I said, he's not supposed to be a good guy. Like, she's supposed to, like, fall over, like, over him.
Well, I don't think they were totally condemning him either. I think they were
I don't think they were either.
Like I said, I think they were supposed to be cool people.
Yeah.
It's just that we're not seeing it through their eyes.
Yeah.
I think that's what was intended. That, oh, man, they're cool and hip. They're 20, right? They're in there. Maybe we're going on a little too long about it.
Yeah, we
are. They're 20. I'm just trying to get into the mindset of who wrote this. They're 20. Well, just a decade before, you had guys who were 17 and 18 flying down bombers and fucking burning Japan down. Those were young adults in that era. They weren't really kids.
Yeah.
But they were considered to be... I think they were supposed to be cool. We were supposed to think that they were cool, I think.
Yeah, I don't, you know, I don't know. Because I think so. I wasn't alive back then, and I don't know. But, so she's in this, and there's all this weird shit going on. And then, significantly, like I said, she keeps seeing this ghoul dude, like, turning up. She sees him outside the window. She sees him, like, down in the lobby of, like, it's not the lobby, but it's, like, you know, the living room of the boarding house she's staying at. And she's, like, kind of freaking out about it, and nobody else seems to see him. Then she starts having these kind of... fugue states, I guess you would call them, where it's like she's at a department store, like shopping for clothes, and everything's normal, like she's trying on dresses and whatnot, and then all of a sudden there's like this kind of weird, like wavy kind of shit happening, and then she goes back out and suddenly it seems like no one can see her or hear her anymore. So she's just kind of like talking to people and they're just ignoring her and like nobody can see her, and it's like kind of wigging her out, and like that happens a couple of times. Something I never noticed before, and then I saw, like, an analysis of this that someone was talking about. They said that the couple times that happens where she goes into these weird fugue states where no one can see or hear her, even though she's talking. And it's weird because it's, like, the only noise you can hear, like, is noises she makes, like her footsteps or whatever. But what the thing that brings her out of this fugue, and I think it's both times, or it's two or three times that she has one of these, is birds singing. And I said, I wonder, was that intentional? Because I thought that, like, some kind of birds are, like, what do they call them? Like a psychopomp, right? It's like they transfer souls, like from the living to the dead. So maybe they were trying to like imply that she was like in between. Yeah. Which I mean, you know, it's, or maybe that was just the only sound effect they had, or maybe they did think about it. I don't really know. But so she has like these weird fugues and starts wigging out. And during one of these fugues, she happens to run into a doctor. He's not a psychiatrist. He's just like some kind of regular doctor. And he's like, well, come back to my office. I'll help you out. And so she's like talking to him. And she explains all this shit that happens, and he's basically saying, you know, he doesn't say this, but it's like, this is the implication. Well, you're just a woman and you're hysterical, whatever. You know, it's, this dude doesn't really exist. You said nobody else saw him. It's like, maybe you're having like sometimes survivor's guilt because your friends died in the accident and you didn't, and it's like wigging you out, and you're not really, you know, you're not really dealing with your trauma or anything. You've just decided to like shut off. He doesn't use those words, but that's kind of what he's saying. That's what they would say in like modern parlance. Because she, like I said, she tells the guy, I don't feel like I belong here. I feel like, you know, I'm not interested in other people. I'm not interested in religion or anything like that. So what they're trying to say, and I think they even say this a couple times outright, is that she is now soulless. I think that even when she's playing the organ at the church, she ends up getting fired from the church because she spaces out when she's playing the hymns or whatever and starts playing some more like demonic-y sounding shit, which, you know, it's like kind of creepy carnival kind of music. And then like the priest or preacher or whatever, like gets all fucking flipped out and is like, what's that sacrilegious shit you're playing? It's like, get the fuck out of here, you heathen. So it kind of goes like that. So I think the implication is that she doesn't have a soul anymore. I don't think, because spoiler alert, when you get to the end, there's this whole thing where she finally goes, like, is drawn back to this carnival, which she's kind of kept coming back to this abandoned carnival because she's, like, obsessed with it. And she goes there, and then there's all these ghouls, and they're all, like, dancing around, and, like, the main ghoul is, like, dancing with a ghoul that looks like her. And then she runs away from them at the end and falls down in the sand, and then, like, they show all these cops, there would be like, well, her car is parked here, but then like where she fell down in the sand, like there's no body and there's no like footprints leaving from it. And so they can't figure out where she went. And then they go back to Kansas from the beginning. And then they show that they're dredging the car from the very beginning of the movie. And she's still in there.
Yeah.
So she's been, so you can say, yes, she's been dead the whole time. But the thing about it is that I don't think it's as simple, you know, it's not like a Sixth Sense type of thing, like M. Night Shyamalan, like rip this off. I don't think she's necessarily a ghost. I think it's either she's some kind of like weird revenant. Like I said, she's walking around like just her, like some version of her body is walking around, but it doesn't have the soul in it because it's back in the car. Or she was dying under there the whole time, and then the whole movie was like a weird like dream that she was having.
Yeah.
Of these ghouls like coming to get her, come and get her soul. You know what I mean?
The narrative of the movie was unclear. I mean,
well, it's ambiguous. Yeah, and I think that was on purpose.
I knew what they were talking about as soon as she, you see her on the bank after the damn car went into the water. She was dry.
Well, no, she wasn't. She was wet.
Okay.
She was wet and muddy.
Okay. I thought she was dry.
No.
Anyway, you just like, why would only she survive? I knew that they were going to say she was some kind of ghost or something.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think, like I said, I don't think
she was dry at first, though.
No, she wasn't exactly, I don't think she was exactly a ghost because she interacted with other people. It was just sometimes they couldn't see her.
Yeah.
So it's almost kind of more like she was in the car the whole time and that was like a projection. And that was almost kind of like a dream,
a hallucination of
like the ghouls or like to come in like fighting over her soul or something like that. So maybe like the whole thing in Utah was just like all in her head. It was just like a dream of like dying, which like I said, is that's a thing that's been done in stories. That's shit.
That would make the most sense.
Well, that's going back to fucking Ambrose Bierce, an occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, which when did that come out? 1832, something like that. Like that short story where it was like a dude being hung and it seemed like he escaped and went through all these adventures and blah, blah, blah. But then it turned out that he was just, that was, you know, a projection in his head, like he actually did die.
So I kind of feel
like that's where they were going
with
that.
That would make the most sense.
Because if she's not a ghost, because people can see her and interact and touch her and things like that most of the time.
She must have been back in the car dying.
I think she was back in the car dying and it was just like a projection, which, like I said, in a way kind of makes it better because then that's, It's this weird, surreal, like, dream that she's having while her life is being, like,
sucked because
away.
I guess it doesn't make any sense to any other way.
Yeah, because if she was a ghost, like I said, because the thing about the about the Sixth Sense, which we were talking about before, is yes, spoiler alert, Bruce Willis was dead the whole time, but the only person that interacted with Bruce Willis was the kid who could see dead people. Yeah. Nobody else interacted with him or touched him or anything, which you don't really notice the first time that you watch it if you don't know what the thing is. But in this one, people absolutely do touch her and interact with her, and most of the time, other than the few fugues that she has, you know, people can see her and hear her, and she's interacting with people normal. So I don't think that she's supposed to be a ghost.
Yeah. So I guess that's why it might be considered, you know, some people consider this an important movie, which I guess maybe it does. It would seem that way. I didn't really think there was much to it. I mean, like I said, the movie's kind of dated.
It's all atmosphere, pretty much. And like I said, it looks way better in black and white.
Pretty sure there's a bunch of social commentary that we're not picking up because we're just, you know, not old enough.
Well, I mean, all the things that they say about her that make her weird are trying to make her seem like she's soulless, as in she doesn't care about the church. She's just playing at the church for money.
I didn't realize that.
Like she doesn't give a shit about that. She's not interested in a relationship. Like I think the creepy dude even asks her, "Are you afraid of men?" And she says no. But it's just like I think that maybe that angle would have played better if that dude wasn't such a creep. Because it's like any woman in their right mind would not want anything to do with that fucking rapey motherfucker. Yeah. So it's like if the dude had just been like normal, that might have played a lot better if she was like freaked out by that dude, you know, who was like a perfectly
nice. I don't know, man. You know what I mean? I kind of have a sneaking suspicion that we were supposed to think that guy was cool.
I don't know. I don't think so.
It's hard to tell because, like I said, it's hard to put yourself. Okay, look, I mean...
Well, he says there's a point, like, he takes her out on a date, right? Because he won't take no for an answer. Yeah. And to be fair, she is kind of like... Because she's scared because she doesn't really know what's going on. So sometimes she's just like, hey, fuck off. And then sometimes she's like, no, I don't want to be alone. So she's giving him some mixed signals, too. I will give him that. But, you know, because she doesn't really know what's going on and she's freaking out also because she thinks she's losing her marbles, right? So, you know, but when he takes her out on the date... And then he just, like, says horrible shit to her, like, whoa, you don't like to drink either, you know, and he's, like, picking on her. But then he sees, like, a friend of his, and he says to the friend that, you know, one, he lies about who he is.
That's the normal kind of pig you usually bring in here. It's all kinds of cool shit.
Yeah, well, and he says to that guy, he's like, I don't want her, it's like, you know, she's kind of more of a classy chick. I don't want her knowing that I know dudes like you.
Yeah.
So you're meant to, and like I said, they don't make a secret of the fact that he's a drunk either. Yeah. So I don't think he's supposed to be, like, the ideal man. Mm. You know what I mean? And I know that, like, back then, men could get away with being a lot more pushy than nowadays. Like I said, nowadays you get pepper spray in your face. But back then they could get... But I don't think that he was supposed to be, like, a normal dude. I think he was supposed to be, like, kind of a creep. But maybe not as much of a creep as nowadays. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. But honestly, if... I know that they were just trying to make it seem like she didn't have a soul. Like I said, she wasn't interested in friends. She wasn't interested in seeing her family, which, you know, one of the... people mentioned when she was going on the trip, you know, she wasn't interested in church. She wasn't interested in anything like that. She didn't care that her friends were dead, you know, that kind of shit. So
I think there's a bunch of stuff in there that generationally we're missing. I mean, I can watch a well-written movie like Rebel Without a Cause. I don't understand half that damn movie.
Well, that's what I'm saying. You know what I mean? So pretty much every movie from that era. Yeah. Well, it's just... I mean, and that's going to happen. There's nothing wrong with that because you didn't grow up during that time period. So there's obviously going to be some shit that you know, some context that you're missing out on.
Yeah,
it's a shame, but that's
the context, and it's also like the situation that you were brought up in at that time. Their consciousnesses were very different. I mean, fucking, you know, characters are doing and reacting in ways, you know, like he's. The dude from Rebel Without a Cause, what's his name? Fucking
James Dean's
overreacting to things in weird ways, and like, dude, man, shut the fuck up, you bitch. I mean, he's like whiny, and I don't know what he's upset about because I wasn't brought up in that era, so you know what I mean. Fucking, you know, he's got problems that didn't exist in my time.
Yeah, well, the thing about it too, and I think we've talked about this before, is that. you didn't really see a lot of movies about teenage rebellion because it was kind of like a new thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it was like, oh, here's this new youth thing that we're doing in movies.
Yeah,
about.
But it was hard to understand what he was upset about because I didn't grow up in that in the environment.
Well,
that
yeah.
He was in. But evidently, kids of that era loved that movie and could really relate to what he was complaining about.
Yeah, so
about.
Obviously they so, struck a nerve.
Yeah, they loved that movie.
It's just
they,
we didn't grow
and
up in it.
They knew
then,
exactly
so the
what he was
is...
talking about, and but we can watch it and go, what's he talking about?
So the context is
The context isn't there.
Yeah, which, you know.
Right.
And like I said, even shit that came out when I was a kid, like in the 70s, even those movies, like even though I understand the context more because I was actually there and I kind of knew what was going on, even now, sometimes I'll watch movies from the 70s and be like, wait, what?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's just, so, you know, and there's really no way to get around that because, I mean, unless you really, really, like, study. But I don't think unless you grew up in that time period, you're not going to be able to, like, really, like, relate
some of the stuff,
same way that somebody that age would.
Some of the stuff from the 1930s, though, is just instantly understandable because it never really gets too deep. It's all just, you know what I mean, kind of on the surface.
Yeah, which is strange. I've seen some movies
30s,
from...
you understand everything.
Yeah, like, from way longer ago that are more... Which, yeah, that's very odd. Well, because I guess because history is more, like, cyclical.
It's kind of like a cycle.
Like, stuff that from the 50s, I'm just kind of like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
But it's like, you know, older stuff, like from the 20s and 30s, I'm way more into that. Because, you know, I like a lot of movies from, like, the 20s and stuff. Well, they're,
There wasn't as much ambiguity to anything either.
Well, and culturally, it wasn't as uptight
as the 50s. Yeah, they
weren't
uptight. I think it's what it was.
So it's a lot more similar to shit nowadays than
the 50s. You watch
the
Black Cat, man, and he's talking about necrophilia and fucking enslaving people's fucking daughters and wives.
All that pre-Hays Code shit.
Yeah,
is just like,
fucking Satanism
in
the upper class.
Like I said, you can make one of those movies now and people be like, yeah.
Yeah. Fucking Bela Lugosi tortures Boris Karloff to death. With the fucking pliers? Damn.
Yeah. See, they were hardcore back then. Like I said, I kind of feel like the 50s was, you know, it was just so...
They were so inhibited, you couldn't understand what they were talking about a lot of
times. That a lot of the stuff, and, you know, a lot of the social, like, and gender roles and stuff like that were just so rigid that it was just kind of like, I don't really get it anymore. So, you know, but I mean, I can see where they were coming from, but I didn't grow up during that era, and it's just, like, weird to me. But so, yeah, so I don't know. We're just, I can't believe we spent so much time, like, on that one creepy character.
Well, it is kind of, that is an anomalous feature of this movie, I've just got to say. I mean, I watched the movie, the movie
that
is mostly...
That dude is, like, so oily and
perverted. Most of the movie, I didn't really think, but that particular character, what got me was I wasn't sure how I was supposed to feel about the guy. It was ambiguous.
A lot about this movie is ambiguous, like I said.
Right.
But that's, in a way, I think that's why a lot of people dug it, because it was just kind of like this strange, like, one-off kind of
fucking shit. I kind of got the feeling that they... that you were supposed to kind of think that that dude was futuristic and ahead of his time. That's what I think that they were what they were trying to get at.
I don't know. Maybe
from
somebody
the viewpoint of the 60s, maybe he was.
Maybe somebody that grew up during that era would be able to like.
Like oh yeah, he's
that.
Cool. He's cool. He's actually
I'm just
saying
like,
what's
holy,
on his mind.
Holy crap! What a fucking perv.
Yeah. He's saying what's on his mind. He's treating a woman the way she should be treated. That's right. So see, she's looking at it from a different viewpoint. I'm going like, I think some dudes. Think
well,
that this
I mean,
is
you
the
might be right to an extent, but like I said, I don't think he was supposed to be a good guy because they did have some traits.
Yeah.
That were about him that were not good. Like I said, his alcoholism. Because he was, like, drinking in the morning, like, just putting
But they might have been justified. Well, we're all drinking because this shit sucks because you can't be like this motherfucker. You can't tell a woman what you really think. You know, it's like that. You know, keep that bitch in line. That's right. You paid for that beer. Make her drink it.
Put some roofies in there.
Right. Why ain't you roofied her already? Damn. That's shit from the past. I think Jay's looking at it from a female point of view, but I'm looking at it from a male point of view. That may have been a role model. See?
God, I hope not.
That might have been. That's the way I was looking
Well,
at it.
Well, no, I'm not arguing. It might have been. Like I said, I'm not a dude, and I'm not the dude that made this movie either, it's kind of like...
That might have been a men's rights fucking role model, I think is what that was. They're holding him down. Society's holding him down. And now this woman's holding him down. Damn, he paid for the beer put out. I think that's what they're talking about.
Well,
holy yeah. keeping their legs closed.
Like I said, it's hard to tell because there was a lot of that shit going on in the 50s. Yeah. So yeah, I'm just saying that it's like, I understand why that character was in there, but I don't know.
What you're
like,
supposed to think.
Well, no, I mean, I don't know him being that like that. I think it would have worked better if he was more like straight-laced, because then it would have seemed weirder that she was refusing him. You know what I'm saying? That's all.
A couple years later, dudes like that were replaced with all these Age of Aquarius, Age of... Here's some pot. Now open your legs. It was basically...
Well, that worked much better.
That worked a lot better. But I think it was that same kind of dude.
Free drugs? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. All right. So anyway, this has been our 50s dissertation. This is early 60s, but it's still kind of similar.
Yeah, very 50s. Our
dissertation about Caramel Souls.
Yeah.
Like I said, this movie is free. It's everywhere. If you want to see it like super beautiful, if you're like really into, you know, film and everything, I would recommend the Criterion Collection version because I've heard that it looks gorgeous. But if you just want to like watch it and laugh, then you can watch the Riff Trax versions, of which there are two Riff Trax versions, live and regular, and then there's one, I think, with just Mike, and they're all on Tubi for free if you want to watch those, and the original version is also on Tubi for free, and it's also on Shudder, so go watch it, you know, why not? Mm-hmm. Well, like, you have anything better to do. Anyway, so that'll do it for this movie retrospective. We'll be back for the next one. Bye.